We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to the... Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess, Chess Books Recaptured. Of course, this is a monthly book review. Each month, I am joined by a different guest co-host, and this month's co-host most likely is no stranger to a lot of you listening, for he is a popular chess author. He's been on the podcast before, episode 209, as an accomplished adult improver. He's also our second consecutive Danish dad. By day, he works as an archivist in the Library of the Danish Parliament. But of course, he has written a few chess books, and he's got another one on the way. He is the founder and the CEO of the Say Chess Publishing Empire, as we will discuss. But today, what we're going to be talking about is the book Questions of Modern Chess Theory by Isaac Lipnitsky. This was a book that was published in the USSR in 1956, and it's kind of like a deep cut classic. It's for those who know, it's totally respected, and we'll talk about some of the chess legends who have spoken highly of this book. But first, let's welcome Martin Eustason back to Perpetual Chess. Martin, how are you?
I'm fine, Ben. Thank you for inviting me to this interview and big book recap, and I've been looking forward to it. And yeah, I'm very humbled by calling my small book business an empire, but it's become a fun joke here on the Perpetual podcast. So
yeah, it's good that you explained. So that's become a bit of a running joke. Martin, of course, is a good exemplar for a lot of chess fans in that he's rated about 1800 FIDE, but has managed to build a successful side hustle, sort of pursuing his passion for chess, but also giving to the chess community in the books that he has produced. And a lot of you may be familiar with his Blindfold Endgame visualization book, or his redone Capablanca book. Of course, we recapped the Capablanca book quite recently. And as I said, he's got a new one on the way. But Martin, in addition to, he shares so much with the chess community. So it's nice to see that, the jokes about it being an empire aside, it is an admirable and beneficial side hustle. But the order of the day, Martin, is, of course, questions of modern chess theory. And yeah, when we had talked about reviewing a book this month, this one was your suggestion. So what was it about this book, Martin, that made you think it might be a good choice?
I think it was mainly because you reviewed Nimzowitz's My System in a previous recap, and I had also read that book this summer, and I thought that it was would be a nice continuation. And also, when I started my YouTube channel some years ago, it was with the goal to cover this book from front to cover, and it was something that I never managed to accomplish. but then I thought, okay, this is an excellent opportunity to finish the book and get something out of it. And and I can maybe say that, like, the reason it caught my notice was after reading Frank Brady's book Endgame about Bobby Fischer, where I think he says that Fischer read this book in the Russian edition, maybe with some help from his mother, and I think Brady says that it was a very important book for Bobby Fischer. So, and since I'm very interested in Bobby Fischer and his life, I thought that this would be an interesting book to read.
Yeah, Karpov also was a big fan and wrote one of the forewords. And yeah, the legend goes with Fischer that it was one of the primary books that helped him learn to be able to read Russian. He, of course, was legendarily a voracious chess reader. And back in those days, Chessable and YouTube didn't exist. So that was how you were getting your information. And yeah, Fischer, I believe, quoted this book in 60 Memorable Games at some point. Was a big fan. And digging in, I can see why. I can also see why it's compared to My System. Of course, listeners who heard, I am Christoph Zalecki, and I recap My System. We'll have heard that we had, I guess, mixed feelings about the book. We feel like it didn't hold up that well. And so without further ado, I'll just say I didn't feel that way about this book. I mean, it felt quite modern. And it's sort of similar style to My System in that it covers a lot of different chess topics. It's not about one small thing, but it also doesn't try to cover everything. But it's quite impressive. Well, is that your overall impression as well, Martin?
Yeah, I agree, Ben. I think the difference between My System and this book is, like, it's questions of modern chess theory is a lot more concrete, I think. While My System is like Nimzowitz tried to explain everything in chess and like a big nature system with organisms, and he talks about a chess game as an organism and how it develops as a, like, a living thing, and I think this is a totally different kind of book where Lipnitsky is a lot more down to the point, I think.
Well said. Yeah, clearer prose, no crazy diagrams, none of Nimzowitz's eccentricities. And to be fair, this book did come out decades later than My System, published in 1956 in the USSR. And another point of interest about this book, one reason that I think a lot of people listening may not have heard of it, again, for hardcore chess fans, this book is considered a classic, but it doesn't come up, like, if you just think about how often books are recommended on this podcast, it hasn't come up that often. And I think a big part of the reason why is it was only translated to English in 2008.
Yeah, it's amazing.
By Quality Chess, yeah. So that obviously, limited the impact. Not all of us are like Fischer. Not all of us can learn Russian just to read this book.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can see why it gets compared to my system,
but I would say that I'm happy. I've read my system first, and this then the questions of modern chess theory afterwards, because I felt like I needed some of the information in my system to build on, or maybe to re-understand in a new way, because Lipnitsky is like trying to theorize about some of the ideas of hypermodernism, which is the school of Nimzowitsch. So it's a new take on those idea of the center and how to attack the center, and yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot more details to get into. One question I feel like we should answer early, just for anyone listening and wondering, is for what level chess player do you think this book would be most beneficial? What do you think, Martin?
It's definitely not a beginner's book, and I would say it's advanced material, but there's also some a lot of great games that intermediate players could benefit off, but it's not really written for the beginner intermediate player. I think it's written for the peers of his time, and that's how I get it. It's a very short introduction in the book, but I feel like he's writing for the chess masters in at his time.
Yeah, I agree. It's the language is not inaccessible, so that means that probably a lot of people can read it and at least pick up a few things. But in terms of like maximizing the utility of the books you read, I would guess for say 1800 Lee Chess Rapid, meaning 1500 FIDE/USCF/chess.com, something like that. In that general ballpark is where I would think it starts to make the most sense for you to devote your time to reading this book. If you're trying to categorize it in terms of some other books that often get recommended on this podcast, I would definitely, I don't want to reread my system, unlike you. So I wouldn't include that in the conversation, but I might do something like Logical Chess Move by Move before this, Winning Chess Strategies before this, Simple Chess maybe right before this. And I would say, and you know, obviously game collections can go somewhere in there as well, but I would say this could come somewhere after that. I would place it firmly in the intermediate category. But if there's things you don't understand, I don't feel like you would be like totally lost, because it's not necessarily going to be a language issue. It's more just that familiar feeling of not knowing why a certain move that isn't explained isn't explained. And, you know, that's part of chess learning. So, And in terms of like a ceiling, you know, I'm 2100 at peak, and there's plenty to learn from this. I was amazed by his games, and there's, we'll talk more about the format of the book in a minute, but
I think one of the reasons I said like it's maybe more towards advanced, it's like it's because it's not, I don't feel like it's like a standard alone book where you get the whole package. It's like building blocks that you can add to something you already have read some about chess.
Yeah, and it's because it's not a tactics workbook, you know, there's a lot of prose. I think that often leaves like some more wiggle room in terms of when you can read it. Because no matter your level from 1500 to 2200, there's certainly things you'll pick up from it. So we're going to share a few more details about the book, and then we're going to and a few more details about the author, and then we're going to dig deeper. But first, we're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. Listeners, I've got good news and I've got bad news. The bad news is I'm still stuck at being behind on the clock in 77% of my blitz games, neither getting better nor worse, just spinning my wheels endlessly. The good news is, unlike me, Aim Chess has managed to improve its product even more. They've totally redesigned the interface of aimchess.com. They've added the ability to use Aim Chess even if you don't have a linked account on chess.com, Lee Chess, or Chess24. They've expanded payment options to include Google Pay and Apple Pay. So doing everything they can to make Aim Chess even more user-friendly and fun, accessible, and educational. So if you haven't already, be sure to check out aimchess.com. And as always, use the code PERPETUAL30 to receive a 30% discount if you decide to subscribe.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we are back. So we mentioned that Karpov wrote one of the forewords. Another foreword was written by Grandmaster John Shaw of Quality Chess. Of course, this was reissued by Quality Chess. One detail listeners should know is, as far as I can tell, there is not an electronic version of this book. I couldn't find it on Forward Chess, even though a lot of Quality Chess's books are on Forward Chess. And I couldn't find one in my Googling. So that was a bit unfortunate. And I've mentioned before in some other books, such as last month's A First Book of Morphe, that there was like a Lee Chess study where even if you didn't have an electronic version, you could just have the Lee Chess study open and play through the moves. It seems like a couple people on Lee Chess have attempted that, but even that, there's no getting around this being kind of an analog book. You can find most of the games that are cited if you Google them on chessgames.com. So I often, would perform the heretical task of looking at the games on my phone while reading the prose. You also, if you want to improve your visualization, of course, it's a classic way to try to do that, just to go from diagram to diagram without playing the moves. There'll probably be some understanding sacrificed, but it is a good way to improve your visualization skills. And as Quality Chess usually does, there's a decent number of diagrams, but you are going to need to get a paper book if you get this one. Did you actually use a chess set for reading this, Martin?
I used a chess set for some of the games, but otherwise I used a board on my phone to play through because sometimes I read on the train and in places where I can't really put up a board. So on my phone and that was one of the things I was a little bit annoyed by the book was like he some places he starts on the first moves of the game and then he jumps to another game and then he goes back to see the ending of the first game he talked about. So there's a little bit jumping around when you don't have the digital version available. So it takes a little bit time to switch through the games.
Yeah, and also there's some game snippets. So some full games, but when there's a game snippet, obviously that limits your ability to just pull up like a Lee Chess or Chess.com analysis board and input the moves. Of course, if you want to be diligent, you can either use an app like Chessify and take a picture from your book and then it'll input the position and then you play it from there on an analysis board, or obviously you could set it up yourself. But we're already talking about something labor intensive. I would say if you can pull it off, this is a book. And it's written in a style such that, you know, and being such a old treasured book, there's definitely something to be said for reading it properly with a chess set. But yeah, as neither of us busy dads managed to pull that off. So what do we need to know? Of course, in addition to the book not being well known, Isaac Lipnitsky himself is far from a household name in the chess world. So what should listeners who aren't familiar with him know, Martin?
I think he, like Ukrainian chess player, died very young, 35 years old, I think. So he had a lot of chess years missing from his life. He won against almost all the strong players of his time, but never really got the chance on the international scene. Maybe because of the USSR bureaucracy, but and he was decorated as a soldier during the Second World War. So he also lost some years there where he obviously couldn't play any chess. And what I can read from the introduction, he wasn't a wealthy man. He lived in it was not it didn't sound like he had so much money.
Yeah, so definitely didn't have as much opportunity. Was an author and a chess teacher as his work, as was fairly common. Learned chess at the House of Pioneers in Kiev, Ukraine. And he was two-time Ukrainian champion in 1949 and 1956. But as you say, untitled, like not even of course, this is back when titles were pretty rare. So I read somewhere that it's estimated that he was, you know, in the top half dozen players in the Ukraine, which of course is a, you know, historical chess powerhouse, but yeah, I guess would have been called a candidate master. But again, when you play through his games, I mean, at least international master strength. I mean, he beat Kiraz, Smyslov, Petrosian, and his writing is very clear. He's a very strong player. And yeah, unfortunate that he died of leukemia at 35, because who knows what other contributions he could have left behind. This is such an amazing book.
Definitely. One thing I thought that was interesting in the introduction to the book was that there was a woman, Ukrainian chess player, Xenia Weisberg, that was editor on the book. And she asked Lipnitsky, why do you write that in some critical positions there aren't any chess laws that apply? I mean, if some laws don't apply, it means there are others that do. And I find that interesting, because it feels like that when you read the book, it's this weighing of chess laws is quite an important concept in the book, in his approach.
Yeah, so this idea that, like, any rule you hear, like a knight on the rim is dim, or castle your king early, or, you know, doubled pawns are bad, or, you know, outposts are strong, or whatever it may be, that generally these can be helpful guidelines, but the devil's in the details. And when you watch top players play, they're breaking these rules all the time. This, of course, is a point highlighted famously by I.M. John Watson in Secrets of Modern Chess Strategy. And if you read, there aren't a ton of online reviews of Lipnitsky's book, but it does often get sort of compared or mentioned in the same way, because of course this preceded Watson's book by nearly 50 years. But what Watson called this idea of rule independence, meaning the great players know when to break the rules. As you say, Martin, it's a common theme throughout this book. And a lot of people were trying to, like, compare the books against each other. I haven't read Watson's book in a while, but I found them to be different. I think I've mentioned before, I really like Watson's book, but to me, it's almost more like an academic type book. It's almost more like a historical development rather than a how-to guide. Whereas to me, I was really impressed, first of all, with the fact that, again, this was written so, you know, so much before Watson's book, but also it's more about, like, it's more concrete, in my opinion. I don't know if you've read Watson's book, but you could speak generally about if you felt this was like a helpful actual chess guide rather than just like an academic, questioning book.
Yeah. I haven't read Watson's book, but maybe I should soon. Definitely, I feel like it's not too academic in a way, and it's but he goes into this debate about like dogmatism in chess and versus the more concrete intuitive and the weighing of the chess laws against each other, and yeah, so I just thought that was an interesting perspective that this Ukrainian women's champion had what I think a big impact on the layout of the book.
Yeah, and you can see this idea in action. There's one game in particular. We should mention format-wise, by the way, that this book is what Quality Chess translated and republished is a truncated version of the original. Apparently, there were like tons of pages about his thoughts on the theory of the Rogozin opening included, and Quality Chess decided that at this point, almost 70-year-old chess theoretical opinings didn't really belong in a sort of reworking of the book. So they cut all that out. In my opinion, it's a wise decision, even though like maybe from a historical perspective, someone might be interested. But what they added was 12 of his games, more or less with his own annotations. So they added them as an appendix. And again, those games are amazing. And he's got a game in there where he beat Petrosian, and those of you listening who heard my recent interview with Grandmaster Matthew Sadler will have heard him mention, obviously, there's this recent proclivity with the strongest engines in the world to treat kings differently, treat how you play with your king differently than players did in the past. And he mentioned, GM Sadler mentioned a recent game of Farrugia's from the Euro Cup, where he does this big sort of king walk in the middle game. Well, in this game against Petrosian, actually, yeah. Lipnitsky does this. It's kind of hard to explain in audio only, but basically it's a middle game with queens on the board, although some pieces are off, and it's a fairly locked structure. And before transitioning to the end game, he walks his king from the king side to the queen side. And I just haven't seen many games from that era.
No, it's an amazing game. I hadn't seen it before, and I was like, wow, this is just a very long king march to pull off, and a great game.
Game, and to beat the legend Petrosian. And for any aspiring content creators out there, I didn't see a lot of YouTube videos about that game, so someone should get on that, because
do it better than me,
because it's impressive stuff.
Yeah, but I can maybe add that I looked up the reviews of the book on Amazon, and there was like 25 or more 5-star reviews of the book, and then there was one-star review, and that guy, he wrote that about the reason why he didn't give it more stars was because of removing the Rogozin part of the book. And he writes that, after all, you don't throw away Mona Lisa from the Louvre because being 500 years old, she is, well, kind of outdated. I kind of understand where he's coming from, but I'm just curious, like how did the book look in its entirety, with, and how much editing did the Quality Chess do to the book? Because I'm just from like a historical perspective, maybe like interested to see how much was removed from this book.
Yeah, we'd have to ask Douglas Griffin or another Russian speaker exactly how it compares, or whoever we should give a shout out to, whoever actually did the translating. But I mean, you know, you can't please everyone. To me, it's to me, it's full stop, no brainer. I don't want 150 pages of old theory in there, you know. And I'm interested in chess history, but like I and most people, when they buy a chess book, you know, the majority of the people are at least hoping, you know, their primary goal is probably to learn some chess.
Yeah.
Translated from Russian by John Sugden. So paging John Sugden. So I also wanted to read again, the intros were pretty fun. They definitely got you fired up for the book. So before we take one more break, I wanted to read what Grandmaster John Shaw of the aforementioned Quality Chess wrote. So John writes, there's a great difference between merely acquiring information and achieving real understanding. In this book, you'll find much that is as vibrant and relevant as ever because Lipnitsky wrote with intelligence and lucidity. He was a champion who could play chess and explain how he played chess. Technology might have changed the way we look at chess, but pieces still move in the same way they did 60 years ago. Many highly acclaimed modern chess writers, especially those from Eastern Europe, proudly acknowledge Lipnitsky's influence on their work. Though he does not have the name recognition in the West of as such established brands as Nimzowitsch, Reddy, or Kotov, he is worthy of a place in the pantheon. Studying Lipnitsky's will make it easier for the reader to make the leap from the ideas of Nimzowitsch to works by Lipnitsky's modern admirers, such as, just to choose one example, those of I Am Mark Dvoretsky. So well said by John. I agree with every word of it. It's a really good book. So we're going to talk about our favorite parts and maybe share a few more quotes. But first, we're going to take one more break and hear from our sponsors. Perpetual Chess is proud, as always, to be brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Of course, Chessable is constantly dropping new courses. Some of their latest include Keep It Simple for Black by I Am Christoph Selecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained. It gives an entire repertoire for Black no matter what you face, and Christoph is always thorough, yet not overloading you with variations. There is also a brand new Lifetime Repertoires Berlin Defense from former U.S. champion GM Sam Shanklin. I hate playing against the Berlin, so I'd rather you not get that one. But hey, if you're looking to learn it, of course, Sam Shanklin does not mess around with his course offerings. And of course, whatever you choose to study on Chessable, you can utilize their proprietary Move Trainer technology to help you remember the lines you learn. So be sure, as always, to go to Chessable.com and take a look at what's new.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
And we are back. And just to share a few more details on the book, there's 16 chapters. Some of the topics are like on the opening, the center and the flanks, evaluating the position. And then there's the aforementioned appendix with games of his, which actually turned out to be my favorite part of all. Now, Martin, when you read this book, did any particular segments or chapters stand out to you as your personal favorites?
I think the chapter on the second chapter on the center and the third chapter on the center and the flanks did an impact on me because I felt like he explained the concept in a good way also I kind of got a picture of the development of the understanding of the center, that it's not just in his view, it's not just getting the pawns to e4, e5, d4, d5, but it's more like a struggle for the center in the sense that you need to be able to keep the center if you want if you engage to take the center, and if you let your opponent take the center, you'll need to be able to fight the center. I think that those chapters were good.
I just while you're looking for your next point, I'll just highlight that I agree with that, and I've noticed that below, like, you know, say below 1700-1800, the importance of the center, I feel like it still gets underestimated. I mean, obviously, I am Andras Toth. I'm a big fan of his work and his Chessable course on the center. And that's one way to get like amazing insights into just how important it is. But this book, again, as Martin said, there's just so many cool examples of situations where one side has either make sure the center is closed before they take operations on the wing, or, you know, switch sides of the board. It's hard to do it justice on a podcast, but I enjoyed that chapter as well. I also like the idea, one of his chapters relates to the idea of critical and settled positions, which I had heard in recent discourse often referred to as sort of dynamic as opposed to static advantages. But this is the earliest mention I've seen of sort of this concept where you can have an advantage in a position where if you don't find the right sequence, the advantage can just dissipate. Or if it's like an end game and your opponent has a terrible pawn structure or something, this is an example of something that he would refer to as a settled position where time is less of the essence. The advantage is there to be exploited over sort of a large number of moves. And he has a lot of great instructive examples of like ways to sort of be on the lookout for that in your games.
Yeah, that was also like the settled position is where you look at the positional principles, and the critical is where you apply calculation. And I could only say when reading some of the examples, it was like he says like the aim is to go for one settled position to a new settled position in your calculations, and some of the example was, I was just like, okay, I'm never going to get this far in my own try to reach a settled position. But I understand the concept, and I think it's a good way to think about chess.
Yeah. And another standout chapter for me is he has one on evaluating the position, which again, hearkening back to my recent interview with Grandmaster Matthew Sadler, that was another thing he highlighted about the modern engines is how good their evaluation function is. And I saw a few people mention online that that's something that they feel like they struggle with in their own games. So he has some useful tips for that, and I'll share this quote that Lipnitsky wrote, which is the art of correctly and objectively appraising a position is the decisive factor in a player's skill, which prompts him to take the correct decision. Yes, appraising the position is objectively is fairly difficult, especially in the conditions of practical play with limited thinking time for your moves. The extremely important idea that a player's actions should flow from a correct assessment of the position was elaborated for the first time by the world chess champion Wilhelm Steinitz. And then he's got some Steinitz games or game snippets in there. It's definitely instructive.
Yeah, and like, and then he also mentions like I think it's a cable match against Chigurin against Steinitz, where it's like a clash of the old school against Chigurin, who is he uses it as like an example of an intuitive player that. It's better at like juggling with these chess principles, and whereas maybe Steinitz was a little bit more dogmatic in his approach to the rules, and I think like Chigurin ended up winning those games against Steinitz because he was better at evaluating the positions.
Yeah, and you can also find that game on Martin's YouTube channel. I mean, there's a lot of useful stuff in here.
And I think the when you scroll through the book, there's like there's some small snippets, highlights of text where Lipnitsky comes with some really good quotes that is like so there's sprinkled out through the book, I think. So there were some chapters that I thought was a little bit not so useful, maybe. And where it was how long does a novelty last? Where it was, I think the main idea I got out of that chapter was that sometimes it lasts long and sometimes it lasts not so long. So I didn't really see any point with that chapter, and it was like 4 pages long, how is an innovation born was a little bit I felt like there was some chapters that was a little bit weaker. Maybe I couldn't find the connection to the other parts of the book in those.
Yeah, and also just naturally, like again, from a book published originally in the 1950s, there's going to be some outdated stuff. And I think how an innovation born, like innovations are born a lot differently now than they are. So yeah, I also felt like the book started strong. Then the middle few chapters evaluating the position, the concrete approach, and from critical positions to settled positions, those were outstanding. And then as you say, it started to drag a tiny bit. But then when I got to the games and the appendix, it just sort of came back with a flourish. And for those, of course, because it was all full games, I was able to input them into LeeChess as I was reviewing them. And I was really impressed with the quality of the moves, the quality of the analysis, even the LeeChess like score calculator. I mean, they were like modern GM quality games just in terms of like his sent a pawn loss. And they were instructive, more importantly, on top of that. So yeah, that just really, really stood out to me, especially again, because the guy wasn't, you know, didn't have the Grandmaster title, but just to see the clarity. And the you know, of course, there's one or two analytical mistakes. You're never gonna catch everything. But the overall, it was super impressive. I mean, one other thing for like students of the classics, for any old chess book, of course, there's gonna be some, you know, a bit of redundancy in terms of the games that you see, like the Anderson Kizaretsky Immortal Game. Is a very famous one, which, by the way, the modern engines are not a big fan of that game. But Botvinnik Capablanca, there was this very famous game where Botvinnik plays Bishop A3, deflecting the queen and then mates him on the king side. Steinitz von Butterleben. So there's several first ballot Hall of Fame type games, but that's again, that's to be expected, and it's always nice to see how different authors weave them in.
Yeah, in chapter 9 he has a chapter on he calls positional flair, and he talks about like the idea of studying chess is like you get a feel for the position if you study chess, and there's a quote that maybe can inspire people to study these games, like where he says, a thoughtful, deep study of chess in conjunction with the tournament practice serves to develop that valuable quality of positional flair, without which no one can think of becoming a strong player. And I thought, okay, yeah, it's important to get this positional flair, and I just thought about when I listened to the Rabbit and Blitz commentary with Peter Ligo this last day, so when every new position he instantly recognized the positional ideas in the available and what is the main idea, and I think sometimes for amateur players you feel like you're landing in some new land and you don't really understand what's happening, but the Grandmaster, he is always has some idea plans to lean on.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that was another sort of major theme of the book, is sort of the inextricable link between the opening and the middle game. And obviously that's something that's come up in the recent discourse, because obviously shout out to Chessable, is amazing for helping you remember moves, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't also have a general idea of the tabias, the typical plans in a position. So be sure to review, if you're doing a Chessable opening course, be sure to review the illustrative games that are provided, and nothing should stop one from going for, looking beyond that to even more illustrative games. Again, it's impressive that he was writing this, and just example after example of sort of how like the opening and the middle game are just connected at the hip, and you really can't study one without studying the other.
Yeah, and I think he has some points about I make the mistake sometimes when I in the opening I see my opponent's move. I look at the move he just made instead of Lipnitsky would say, like, I need to look at my opponent's plan and try to combat that plan, where I think I sometimes, like, I look at the move, what does that move do in this position? But in a deeper sense, I need to look at the plan and see, is it a weak plan or is it a strong plan? I should continue with my own plan here. And and he says that also, that in many other chess theoreticians has, like, said that the opening is just the mobilization of the pieces, while he goes into saying that the plans in the middle game starts already in the opening. And so you don't just need to mobilize the pieces as quickly as possible, but you also need to do it in a way that accommodates plans in the middle game. So that's a little bit of a harmony between the opening and middle game, where he says that the opening is like the initial mobilization, while the middle game is the coordination of the pieces. Maybe he borrowed that from Capablanca. I can't really remember.
Yeah, I don't remember offhand either. But overall, as you say, it's a great, great positional guide. And I would say that is kind of the primary type of improver for whom this book is most useful. Of course, if you're trying to work on your tactics, you should use a tactics book or a tactics trainer or a tactics course. And endgames, of course, next month we'll be covering the classic endgame strategy with Kevin from the Chess Journeys podcast. So we'll be talking more about endgames next month. But if you feel like you don't know where the pieces go when you get out of the opening, this is one of the books that can help you, along with books like Simple Chess, and along with the School of Hard Knocks, of course. And one other small quibble with the book, and I've noticed this in lots of older books, is it kind of ends suddenly. It happens with a lot of chess books. I'm not sure why that is. I guess it's kind of hard to have a big goodbye when a book is primarily, you know, designed to be instructional. But overall, definitely just strong recommendation, basically. Do you have anything to add, Martin? I do want to talk about your current book project a bit and wrap up a few things, but anything else you'd like to share?
I have the same feeling about the book, like the harmony of the flow in the book is a little bit strange. Maybe also why I wanted to know how the original book was presented. But overall, I feel like it has immense value and can be read and reread several times. I think I will definitely go through this book again because I think these games are really instructional and it's a good reminder also, if you feel like if your positional chess needs reworking, then I think that's some great example. And I also think that Lipnitsky is like a positional kind of player. It's my feel of his games and his attraction to chess.
Yeah, definitely not like a crazy attacker. He might be positional to universal, I would say, but definitely, definitely the games are very sort of solid and principled. Again, worth checking out. Now, before listeners, before we let you go, one thing we should say is Martin's newest book is actually for those of you familiar with his blindfold endgame visualization, he's doing a blindfold opening visualization, which of course dovetails nicely with the sometime recurring, often recurring feature of a few blindfold puzzles. So once we say goodbye to Martin, which will not be this moment, then Martin has graciously shared a couple puzzles from the book that I will read for listeners to get a taste of Martin's book. But Martin, what should listeners know about the book?
Yeah, it's I published my first book December 1 year ago, and then then this is the sequel to this first book, because the first book was blindfold puzzles in the in-game studies and positions, and this one I have taken puzzles from the first up to 10 moves deep into the games, and I've looked at often recurring tricks and traps in the opening and made them into 100 puzzles, and I'm working to publish the paperback, but now is the book is available on Amazon Digital and on Kindle.
Yeah, and Martin's books are always basically a steal. I mean, last I checked, it was $3 for this book, and there's well more than $3 worth of value. And as I mentioned at the top, I also think Martin's inspiring in that, like, he's found a niche. He found a gap in the chess market in terms of both his blindfold books. There's not a lot of blindfold training books available, and in republishing the Capablanca book. And Martin, you were mentioning before we were recording that the books, your prior two books, are selling reasonably well.
Yeah. Actually, I managed to publish a third book with 100 headachingly hard maiden two.
Oh puzzles. Yes, also, I have that one too. How did I forget that?
I think in December here I managed to sell over 500 books, which is kind of mind-boggling when I started a year ago. And I'm an amateur chess player here, but I've just got an amazing support from the chess community on Twitter, and it's been fun, and I'm enjoying making these puzzles and getting the feedback.
Yeah, well, when you give to the chess community, it tends to come back around. I think that's been the case. And sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off when you were saying the title of 100. Sorry, I forgot the number. 100. Of course, I have the book upstairs, but is it 100 headachingly hard chess mate and twos, or what's the
100,
exact?
The title is a bit long, but it's 100 headachingly hard mate and two puzzles composed by Sam Lloyd. So it's I've taken the best compositions of Sam Lloyd and made into a mate and two puzzle book.
Yeah, and it. And I worked on that book, and I like books like that, Martin. I do have to confess, it's one of my many books strewn in the graveyard of chess books that I didn't finish. But it's nothing personal. It's my own laziness.
You have a lot on the plate.
Yeah, but it's what I like about a book like that is it's challenging. But if you stick with it hard enough, like long enough, at least at my level, you should eventually get it, because you're going to look at every single move sooner or later, and it's only made in two. So it may take you 10 or 15 minutes, but sooner or later, you should be able to solve it. And I think that's a good mix of, again, being challenging, but not being one of these puzzles where when you see the answer, you're like, well, I was just never going to get that, you know?
Yeah. And I can say, like, in the regards to the blindfold books, I'm not a blindfold master in any kind of sense. I was searching for material because I wanted to learn and practice this skill, and I couldn't find anything. So that was the motivation to making the blindfold books.
Yeah. So, and of course I've plugged Improve Your Chess Now, which has, you know, classic book by Grandmaster Jonathan Tisdall, which has some blindfold puzzles. And I myself have mentioned that I wish that there were more of those. And by the way, that's a book that, I mean, I would say Improve Your Chess Now is a bit more on the psychological side than Questions of Modern Chess Theory. But it did remind me of a few modern books, that in Street Smart Chess by Axel Smith, in that it just kind of tackles a sort of a wide array of topics. He doesn't try to answer every question, but just says, like, here are some ideas and here are some things that might help how you think about them. And Martin, before we let you go, we had talked about, again, I would like to make a donation to a charity, and in lieu of paying you for all your work from your busy schedule, and we're gonna hook up Chess and Slums again. Is that right?
Yeah, I've been following Tunde on Twitter and seeing these the boys getting to play chess and seeing the joy in their eyes, is I think it's a good cause to support.
Yeah, fantastic cause. I know Levy Rosman recently made a big donation to them, and we try to support them here when we can. And it's fun just to watch Tunde blow up. For listeners who didn't hear his interview, he's a very inspiring guy. But it's funny, like just today he was tweeting like he's been recognized on the street like 5 times today or something. Like he's becoming this like huge star, rightfully so. Yeah. So shout out to Tunde if you hear this. So I think, Martin, we're ready to say goodbye. As I said, listeners, if you're into the blindfold puzzles, please stick around. If you're not, then we will catch you hopefully at the end of January with a review of the classic book, one of my personal favorites, Endgame Strategy by Mikhail Shereshevsky. So thanks again, Martin.
Well, you're welcome. I enjoyed it, Ben. So.
Oh, and we should say, of course, that listeners probably know where to find you, Martin, but you've got we didn't plug your newsletter yet, your email list.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, and there you can also sign up on my newsletter on getreview.com.
They can sign up for your email list even if they're not on Twitter, right?
Yeah, you can get a link from me, Ben. So
okay, so I'll drop the link in the show notes, and thanks again, Martin. Welcome back to any of you hardcore chess improvers working on your blindfold visualization skills. I am going to share two of Martin's puzzles with you here from his new book, Blindfold Opening Visualization. So in each case, you're looking to find the best move in a given position. I don't want to say anything more than that, but it could be a way to win significant material, or it could be checkmate. So without further ado, oh, and by the way, Martin's first puzzle is from the easy category, and the second puzzle that we share will be from the intermediate category. So here comes puzzle number one. As always, the link with the moves will be listed in the show description. If you want to play through them in your head yourself, there will also be a link to a diagram that will have the solution, so you won't risk seeing the solution by looking at the show notes, but if you click through to the diagram, then you would find the answer. So here we go. Here's puzzle number one. It is only 5 moves before we get to the puzzle. Move one, white plays e4, black plays e5. White plays 2, knight f3. Black plays 2, knight c6. White plays 3, bishop b5. So we have a Roy Lopez. Black plays pawn to d6. White plays knight to c3. Black plays knight to e7. White plays knight to d5, moving the same piece twice. Black plays pawn to g6, double question mark. So it is white to move, find the best move. Once again, the moves are e4, e5, knight f3, knight c6, bishop b5, d6, knight c3, knight e7, knight d5, g6, and now it is white to move, find the best move. On to puzzle number two from Martin. This one, the puzzle will come after 7 moves. And again, this one is significantly more challenging than the first one. White goes 1, knight f3. Black plays d5. White plays g3. Black plays c5. White plays bishop g2. Black plays knight c6. White plays d4. Black plays e6. White castles. Black plays knight f6. White plays pawn to c4. Black plays d takes c4. D pawn takes c4. White plays knight to e5. And black plays knight takes d4 question mark. And now it is white to move, find the best sequence for white. It is more than one move to get full credit. And I'll reread the moves. 1, knight f3. Black plays pawn to d5. White plays pawn to g3. Black plays pawn to c5. White plays bishop to g2. Black plays knight to c6. White plays pawn to d4. Black plays pawn to e6. White castles. Black plays knight f6. White plays c4. Black plays d takes c4. White plays knight e5. Black plays knight takes d4. And now it is white to move, find the best sequence. So if you want more puzzles than that, be sure to check out Martin's book. It's actually $5 on Kindle. It is no longer $3, but still well worth it. And on that note, goodbye for now, and thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, and or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Podcast Network.